welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends, and especially this movie this week. It's going to be a very serious discussion.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, The Wizard of Oz is coming to the Sphere in Las Vegas, and people are mad. Full disclosure, I love the Sphere. I love the Sphere. It's a $2.3 billion technological marvel, by far my favorite landmark on the Las Vegas Strip, with its garish yellow happy face kind of beaming joy down upon the people. You know, all of us degenerate gamblers and gourmands searching for Michelin star concepts to stuff our faces with. Just like the Teletubbies looked at mother, the little baby son thing. That's what it's like when I go to Vegas now. I was literally just in Vegas. I'm recording this from Reno, but I was just in Vegas. And I have now been to the Sphere twice. I've been there twice, both times to see the same movie, Darren Aronofsky's Postcard from Earth. And although it's a glorified IMAX museum film, right? It's a nature documentary with a healthy dash of anti-consumerist preaching and like vaguely misanthropic stuff that you would expect from, frankly, a Darren Aronofsky movie. The ironic juncture of this kind of playing in a structure located in Las Vegas that was built specifically to suck up energy and serve as a monument to consumerism. I love it. I love the whole thing. It's wonderful. It is a genuinely amazing experience, right? It's like, I don't know how to describe it precisely. It's kind of like a feature-length version of the ride Soarin' from the Disney parks that also immerses you in foreign settings and instructs humanity to treat itself like a plague that has to leave the planet. Just amazing stuff. The Sphere, like any attraction, though, needs new experiences if it hopes to justify the $100 per seat ticket costs. Enter The Wizard of Oz, which has been, shall we say, improved for the Sphere, using the wonderful wizards of AI. The image has been upscaled from lame 35 millimeter three strip Technicolor to the glory of digital 16K. Gone is the disgusting grain from the face of Dorothy. Instead, she looks nice and smooth, doll-like, with dead black eyes, like a shark's eyes. I don't know if you like the original movie and how it was framed, how like the people sat in the image and all that. I've got good news for you, though. The image has been expanded up and out. It's got AI actors mimicking the real thing, bringing them from out of frame and into the frame. You used to wonder what Uncle Henry was doing over there just out of the image. Now you can see. Now you can see him walk into frame. I don't know if you ever thought there was a reason that, say, the Scarecrow was seen in close-up when he's first on his little perch in the cornfield. But I've got good news for you now. Now you can see the whole panoramic sweep of Oz. You can see everything. You can see it all.
So there's more corn?
You can see all the corn. You can see corn, wow, and sky, all of these things.
It's extremely corny.
It's infinitely larger. Here is James Dolan, Sphere Entertainment CEO, talking to CBS Sunday Morning. Quote, "Our standard on this was not to modify the film at all, but to try and bring you into it as if you were in the studio when it was shot," end quote. Which, okay, sure. I mean, yes, the movie is 25 minutes shorter now. It's like a 75-minute production instead of the 104 minutes or whatever that it was. But that probably doesn't matter that much anyway. You could easily trim 25 minutes of fat off of The Wizard of Oz. But, you know, think about all the cool things that they will be able to do now, like blow in poppy scents and mimic the tornado that brought Dorothy to Oz. Lots of big, gusty wind coming in. Yes, it'll look like garbage, and yes, it'll be shorter, but it will be an experience. And I got to admit to you guys, I kind of want to see it immediately. I wish it was playing in Vegas right now. I would have bought a ticket. Because here's the thing. This is absolutely an abomination before the eyes of the Lord. And I don't believe for a second any of the arguments being tossed around that this desecration is likely to bring a single new viewer into like the Turner Classic Movies fold, right? That's not who's going to see this thing. But But this also is not akin really to Ted Turner's effort to colorize movies, which was intended as a replacement for home viewing. He wanted to basically get rid of all the black and white stuff, just have the awful fake color things. It's actually I find this weirdly less obnoxious somehow than pan and scan, which was the preferred viewing format for cable and VHS audiences for years. This is a one-off experience in an expensive, far-off location that exists nowhere else in the world, right? This is more like a Broadway adaptation of The Wizard of Oz than it is a cinematic viewing, kind of. In short, I find this to be a despicable use of AI, to horribly deform a classic piece of American culture, but I also need to see it. I need to gawk at this. I need to experience it in the 16K resolution or whatever. Peter, are you also very excited for fake Wizard of Oz?
Well, I'm obviously very excited for larger screens in general. That's the whole thing about the Sphere is like, it's like, okay, so you have a 65-inch OLED at home. Maybe if you're a fancy rich person, you get one of the 82, 83s, whatever they are, the big ones. But then you could go see a movie in IMAX, but we're going to outdo that by like 10 times. It's just going to be so much bigger. And this is the thing, like at some point we're going to need a screen as big as the entire planet. We're going to need the whole Earth to be a screen. And at that point, you have to be like, what do we do then? What do we do? And then we're going to build a Dyson Sphere. Do you guys know what a Dyson Sphere is? It's a Dyson Sphere is this idea you could build basically a whole ring around a planet, but maybe not even a ring, just like a complete sphere around a sun, right? And it just sucks up all the energy and it's this incredible, right? It's like a huge amount of landmass, but it's going to be one big screen. You'll be able to watch an upscaled version of The Wizard of Oz on it, I sure hope, because that's what the future is all about. Bigger and bigger screens forever. And we're going to need AI to do it.
I have an idea. Across the movie aisle live show in Vegas at the Sphere, we all watch the like abomination of like AI Wizard of Oz, and then we do a live show at the Sphere. What do you think? Do you think James Dolan will go for it?
I don't think that they would. I don't think, well, first off, I don't know that anybody would pay $100 a ticket to see that. But also, I don't think that they would want us there making fun of their magnificent production. No, I mean, look, here's the thing. Have you guys actually been to the Sphere by any chance?
No.
Have either of you been for a concert or?
I haven't been. I actually haven't been to Vegas since the Sphere was completed.
Same here.
Yeah. So I actually do find it to be a really interesting marvel of technological accomplishment. It is incredibly interesting. I would like to see more things shot for the Sphere. And the problem is you can't really, like, what's the point of shooting something for a movie screen that can only be seen in one place? You know, maybe they're going to build some more spheres around.
I mean, what's the point of expensive site-specific art installations, right? I mean, did either of you see Christo and Jean-Claude's The Gates when it was in New York?
I did not, but I saw the documentary about it.
I saw photos of it.
I went like 3 or 4 times. When it was up, I was in college and was able to get there pretty quickly. I actually went 2 days in a row once, and it was amazing, right? I mean, I think the thing that's funny to me about the Sphere is that what it is sort of replicating is museums for fine art, right? They're going to be things that are sort of purpose shot for it, that are going to function like fine art installations. And then there will also be these sort of odd, tacky, you know, weird things that attempt to retrofit, you know, big grabs to fill the space. But essentially, it's like a big gallery in Vegas, and people are going to do site-specific installations for it. And I'm all for site-specific installations. I really like them.
And this is how the concerts there basically work, right? So, you know, the reason we were there was my wife wanted to go see Backstreet Boys in concert. And like, you know, the U2 has played there, Fish has played there. When you do a show at the Sphere, you have to make a whole specific thing for it, because the whole point of it is you've got this giant wall that's got all the, you know, it's got these images, and it's a real experience. And it is kind of crazy. It's kind of nuts. I would like to go see a big concert there. I find that very interesting. And it's expensive to do. I think I saw the UFC put on a fight there, and they had to spend tens of millions of dollars to like create the actual create the images that would go with it and everything else. Make it so you could actually shoot the thing in 16K and broadcast it on the screen. So it'd be like, you know, kind of playing in simulcast. But at the same time, they also did things like add haptic sensors to the seats so you could feel it when a guy got hit. Like, that is weird and kind of cool and like interesting. I don't know.
So the way to think about this, I think the historical comp is a theme park, and very specifically some of the stuff that that was at Universal Studios in the 1990s, T2 3D, which, yes, was an original sort of built for Universal, along with a stunt show that interacted with a 3D movie. But even more than that, what this reminds me of is a much more advanced and more modern and more expensive version of the Alfred Hitchcock show at the Alfred Hitchcock 3D theater that used to be in Universal Studios in Florida. I don't know if it was at any of the others. I never went to any of the others. And what they did was sort of put together a clip reel of Alfred Hitchcock material and then 3D-ize it, right? And it's absolutely, and there's some live programming, like actors and stuff who were interacting with some of this. There was stuff that you could feel, if I recall correctly, you know, sort of a predecessor to like some of the 4DX experiences that we see in more commonly in theaters now. But at the time, this was like a big novel technique, right? And it was a thrill. It wasn't there to get you to appreciate the fine and the fine art and craftsmanship, like the cinematic, like, you know, the technical specifics of Alfred Hitchcock, who is one of the greatest directors ever made. The idea was that this is a big, ridiculous, for everyone kind of immersive experience that is not intended it really in any way to give you this, just the movie, right? I mean, yes, they're advertising this as The Wizard of Oz as you've never seen it before, but in some ways that's right. Like, it's The Wizard of Oz as you've, I've never seen it without all those, the minutes that they are cutting out. And I've also never seen it with all the extra stuff that they're putting in there. And it's just a different way of thinking about presenting the Wizard of Oz as like a, as concept rather than as very specific product. And there's, this is built in, like, for better or for worse. And we can argue about like what, you know, exactly how cinephiles or movie lovers should feel about this sort of thing. Format modifications are a huge part of cinematic history. In many cases, they're modifications that I think degraded the work, right? Like going from the big screen to a pan and scan VHS, that's not great. Going from the big screen to not just a pan and scan VHS, but pan and scan cut for television presentation with commercials. And instead of saying the bad words, you say, this is what happens when you, something, a stranger in the Alps, what's the word in there, right? When you, it's from Big Lebowski. It doesn't matter, right? Like snake in the grass, right? Snake in the grass. It's these things. Film has always been modified to the environment, to the technology, to the format. And while I don't want to say this is literally no different in any way, there is absolutely a history of taking movies, cutting them up, doing stuff to them, and changing their presentation in order to work for a specific time, place, and technology.
Yeah. And look, I mean, The Wizard of Oz in particular has been subject to all sorts of remakes and reimaginings, whether it's The Wiz or, you know, the Broadway blockbuster spectacle of Wicked, and now the two-movie blockbuster spectacle of Wicked, because apparently we're all really interested in where the characters from The Wizard of Oz went to college and like what they did there and who they hung out with. I think you know, this is sort of a side question relative to the questions of artistic integrity, emerging technology, but this does sound to me like the most boring possible expansion of The Wizard of Oz, right? Like, I like corn, but I'm not sure I'm going to fly to Vegas and pay $100 to see like more corn in 16K. And I suppose that...
Do you really love The Wizard of Oz? You got to ask. If you're not going to pay for that extra corn...
I have to be honest, I probably love corn more than I love The Wizard of Oz. And yet, this does not compel me. And so part of it is, you know, part of it is like, how are we seeing it? Does the upgrading, does the sort of upscaling matter? But to me, it just, you know, if you're going to reimagine the sort of classic work of cinema, this is one of the dullest possible ways to do it. I mean, and I'll say that until I get like physically sucked up by a tornado in the sphere and like, you know, delivered to the land of Oz.
There was a Twister ride at Universal that, like, you got to experience the full wind blast of a tornado.
I have no interest in that.
Yeah,
none.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think there. Yeah, if you want to liken it to, again, a theme park ride, which, again, there's a big element of Postcard from Earth that feels so much like Soarin', the Disney thing that I've done with my kids a half dozen times, that it is hard to kind of disentangle the two. And there are elements of that in this. They're, you know, they have the wind things going to simulate the tornado. Things are confetti's flying around in the air. It's supposed to be pretty, I want to see it. It looks pretty neat. But at the same time, I do think there's a difference between, if we can bring it back to the artistry of the thing, there's a difference between cutting for language. There's a difference between excision and creation.
Yep.
And there is an element of this, especially if you watch, I'll link to the CBS interview with the folks who made this. And so you can hear them talk about the genius of their own AI. But there is this like weird techno utopian, we can create more from the Wizard of Oz that you've never seen before. And it all looks terrible. It all looks terrible, but also it is it's a different kind of deforming, I think, than a straight up excision would be. It's one thing to cut and say, well, we're not going to have it like this. It's one thing to do the pan and scan because you can't really get it to fit in the screen. It's another thing to say, we're adding action by the actors here. Look at them walking on stage. Look at how great this is. Look, we've got more land and more. And I think there is a fundamental difference there that is weird and bad.
Yeah. I mean, I also have a certain amount of hesitation about sort of rendering, just getting rid of the grain, right? I mean, and look, maybe the folks who made The Wizard of Oz, maybe Frank Albom, like, given the opportunity, would prefer to have had his work adapted in 16K. But part of what is charming about seeing The Wizard of Oz today is seeing what was possible within the constraints of the format and the technology available at the time. And to me, sort of getting rid of that grain and that detail feels perilously close to vandalism. It's the sort of the smallest thing about this, and yet it's the thing that kind of makes me most uncomfortable. It erases, in a way, the sort of the achievement of the original film.
I would kind of like to see L. Frank Baum's 19th century face upon encountering the sphere, and just be like, "This is what your life's work is coming to." This is
I'd like to
got.
See it projected on the sphere, like the great and powerful Oz.
I think we can make that happen.
This is the future. It's coming. It's the kids.
This is such a cop out. This is such a cop out. You can't just say because a thing can happen, we can't judge it.
I'm not
That's
telling
bullshit.
You can't judge
That's
it. I'm
bullshit,
telling you it's
either.
Happening whether or not you do. And like the kids are going to be like, this feels old school. You're watching this on a screen in what is fundamentally two dimensions. Like they're going to want this to be a hologram beamed directly into their mind via the chip that's implanted in their brain. And then they're going to want to be able to walk around in it themselves, modify it, and play with video game objectives.
And they're all going to have dissociative mental disorders.
All right. Ready Player One. Here we come. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-troversy that they're mutilating the corpse of the Wizard of Oz for the entertainment of Las Vegas customers?
Art changes with the times. It's not a controversy.
Alyssa.
Humanity's inevitable self-destruction is inevitable and thus not a controversy.
It's certainly a controversy, but it is very funny. As I was getting onto the plane leaving Vegas, I heard two people talking. They're like, oh yeah, the Wizard of Oz is coming to the Sphere. I can't wait to come back and see that. It's going to be huge, folks. It's going to be huge. People don't want nature documentaries from Darren Aronofsky. They want to have their childhood ravaged
in
front of them.
I'm going to reach
That's
out to
want.
The Sphere's people and be like, across the movie aisle, live in Vegas.
Okay. I don't know if I want to partake. I don't know if I can ethically partake in that, but we'll see. I don't think we're going to have a bonus episode this week. I am technically on vacation, but I wanted to do this episode for you, the people, and to preach the gospel of the Naked Gun. Speaking of which, on to the main event. The Naked Gun, directed by Akiva Schaffer of Lonely Island fame, and produced by Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy and Ted fame. The film is a semi-sequel, soft reboot sort of thing. Liam Neeson plays Frank Drebin Jr., the son of Leslie Nielsen's character from the original series, and indeed one of the jokes in this picture, which is seen in the first trailer and killed every time I saw it with an audience, is all of the characters are the sons of the original characters, which leads to them all being in a hall and like crying and saying, I love you, Dad, I miss you. And then the character who's playing OJ's son, OJ Simpson's son, remember OJ Simpson was in the Naked Gun movies, he looks at a headshot of his dad, and while all the other characters are crying, he kind of shakes his head and walks away. Haha, it's funny because OJ Simpson's a murderer. I could describe the plot here. Basically, Frank is trying to solve a murder that involves a tech billionaire with plans to reenact the plot at the heart of Matthew Vaughn's Kingsman, the Secret Service. Weird little confluence there. But the plot doesn't really matter that much, so I'm not going to bother. What matters are the jokes and the delivery of the jokes. And this is what Schaefer and his team of writers and chronic straight man Liam Neeson have perfectly nailed in this movie. It's both the joke density and the joke delivery. There's like three jokes a page, and you have to deliver them with a straight face. Like the Zucker Abraham Zucker team that made the original Naked Gun alongside classics like Airplane and Top Secret, the joke density of this film is off the charts, with at least one gag, probably two or three, depending, per minute. A combination of witty wordplay riffing on accepted notions of what words mean and how they are used, amusing sight gags, and then completely bonkers fantasy sequences, right? One thing this film notably lacks, has very little of, is referential humor of the kind often preferred by MacFarlane on shows like Family Guy, where there's no like, hey, remember this guy who was on this show doing this funny thing? What was that all about? None of that here. The closest thing to that is a reference to the 2003 song Let's Get Retarded by the Black Eyed Peas. And yes, in this movie, they say retarded. It's that kind of movie. But it's not only that kind of movie. And there is a worse version of this film that really leans into the ain't we stinkers, look at all the forbidden words we're going to say here sort of thing. Rather, this is a movie that, like the original, loves a good English teacher joke, right? Like, this is a movie that will riff on a dangling modifier or the interplay of a homophone or a homonym or just a forced misunderstanding, as when early on in the film, Drebin says to Pamela Anderson's femme fidèle, take a chair. And she says something like, no, thanks. I have plenty of seats at home. This is a perfect sort of like joke on the page. It's a perfect riff on the, but that's not important right now, gag from Airplane, right? This, like its Zaz forebears, is first and foremost a literate movie, one that relies on jokes on the page rather than the endless riffing in a comedic situation and the hopes of stumbling upon some laughs in the editing room. This is not to say it's a literary movie. Different word, literate and literary, not synonyms. The hardest I laughed in this picture was during a scene involving coffee, chili dogs, and Drebin's frantic hunt for a toilet. I was on the floor laughing. But it is a literate movie. It is a literate movie. And it's the kind of a rare thing these days, right? So much of comedy from 2000 and later comes from either putting normal people in extreme situations, movies like Old School or The Hangover, right? Or extreme people in normal situations, cringe comedies like those perfected by Tim Robinson in I Think You Should Leave and his recent A24 movie Friendship, right? And then you see what's funny with that situation. The Naked Gun is, by God, a movie of jokes. It's a movie of jokes. It's a silly movie. And this variety of silliness will not appeal to everyone. Honestly, if I'm being totally honest here, I have never found the Zaz movies or this movie to be kind of like rolling on the floor laughing funny, right? This was not a like, oh my God, I can't breathe funny sort of movie for me. This was more of a, oh, that's clever, that's funny sort of movie. I there were a lot of that's clever jokes, very few like rolling on the floor laughing jokes. But that is how all of these movies have always been for me. Again, Airplane, Top Secret, etc. If you're on the wavelength of those classic Zaz movies, you're going to love this one. Alyssa, I believe that you like just got out of the Naked Gun, right?
Yeah.
You're coming straight from the theater.
I'm about an hour and a half removed from seeing the Naked Gun. And God, it cracked me up. I mean, just, you know, speaking of kind of the joke density in the movie, there's a scene where the evil billionaire is describing what he sees as the problem with society and then his plans to fix it. And he starts talking about how, like, sort of the wrong kind of people have ended up in power in society. Sorry.
Crab hands.
And one of the other,
Alyssa is, for the record, losing it now just thinking about the crab hands joke.
That's so good. People with crab hands.
All right. Peter, while Alyssa recovers, why don't we go back to you for a second. What did you make of the naked gun?
Well, I made about
oh my god. We've lost them both. That's what this movie has done.
So unlike you, Sonny. Unlike you, I don't find this
my
merely
husband
clever.
Is literally worried about me because of how hard I'm laughing upstairs. Everything is fine. I'm not having an episode.
This movie precisely captures my sense of humor, which is like
a lot of puns,
very specifically a lot of puns, very specifically a lot of puns that are designed to derail, but also to disarm, right? So the puns here, this is not your sort of traditional improv comedy, which is always yes and. The puns are designed to ram the conversation into a brick wall so that it cannot go any further. And then what's amazing about all of these movies is that then the characters keep going. And this
yes,
is part of what,
yeah,
make, what makes it so funny is that it's not yes and humor. It's and nope. And nope. And yet the car keeps somehow or another finding another brick wall to drive into and powering through this because everyone somehow or another treats this massive, massive idiocy as something like normal. And you get these, there's just this constant disconnect between this is totally bizarre and moronic. And also everyone is behaving as if it is completely normal. But then in addition to that, it's like, it's really stupid. It's
yes,
unabashedly
yes,
and like proudly. And like, it's, and this is something I was actually quite afraid of going in because I was such a big fan of the Leslie Nielsen Naked Guns, the airplane films, Top Secret, great underrated movie. And part of those movies are not afraid to be stupid, but they are also not afraid to be stupid in a way that is clearly smart. There's a relationship between those films and like Norm Macdonald. It's not the exact same kind of thing, but there's just, they go for the obvious thing, the obvious dumb thing, but in a way that is, but they're just constantly sort of maneuvering conversation or visual jokes or whatever it is towards something irrepressibly silly in a way that, again, it's not designed to get you anywhere in the way that like that so much of this character-based improv comedy, some of which I even quite like, is designed to. It is designed to just sort of like to stop you for a second, but then it keeps going. And part of what's so great about this is you've in your review, you did a good job, I think, of writing about the density, but also the velocity of these jokes. But the speed at which they come and then the lack of the moment that you would normally have in a movie, in a comedy, to let you hear it. To let you process it. These movies don't give you that beat. And so what you're doing is you're laughing on delay all the time, right? You're like laughing about the thing that happened about 3 seconds ago. And then as you're coming up from the laugh, you are discovering that there is yet another completely absurd and ridiculous thing that is happening.
And it's like an ocean of comedy, right? Yes. Like the waves just never stop coming in and you're sort of caught in them.
That's a perfect way to describe it.
Yeah. I mean, Peter, I think what you said about the movie being stupid is exactly right on, right? And I think it illustrates the difference between sort of stupid and dumb, right?
Yes.
Because there's nothing in this movie that is sort of like moronic in a way that makes you feel embarrassed. It's like it is so ridiculous that it crosses over into surreal, right? I mean, there's this moment when Liam Neeson and Pamela Anderson's characters are like at his apartment. They're talking about, you know, his dead ex-wife, and Anderson's character asks, "How did she pass?" And Liam Neeson's character goes into this like incredible riff about like her essentially as a quarterback and how like, you know, this is like what her passer rating was and never got a chance to see it. And Anderson responds like, oh, it sounds like she was a saint. And they're like, well, we would have been okay with that. Like, you know, a bunch of different teams, but not the Browns, right? Like, no explanation, just not the Browns, right? And it's like, it is, the joke is rooted in stupidity in the sense that it's like a deliberate misunderstanding of the question or sort of like a misunderstanding of the reference. But the place it takes you, the ability to mine gold out of that is so incredibly smart, right? And this is a movie that feels deliberate without feeling effortful, right? I mean, you know, that scene I was talking about where you've got these, and I swear to God, I'm not going to lose to get it, or at least I'm going to try really hard. There's the scene where these, you know, the scene where these billionaires are talking about the wrong kind of people are coming into America. And one of them just says, yeah, fish people, right? And you have to imagine that they sat in a room and were like, what is the weirdest thing someone could say in that scenario, right? Like, it's sort of obviously setting you up for it to be something racist, something about immigrants, but like, no, what's the weirdest thing someone could say? And the answer is fish people. But again, then like, while you're recovering from that joke, you know, the evil billionaire is talking about how his bunker and like, what, you know, what's going to be available for the, like, the elect who are allowed to go into the bunker while the world descends into chaos. And he includes this reference to sort of the finest entertainment. And you know what the finest entertainment in the universe is? Weird Al Yankovic, right? And that's sort of perfectly in the spirit of this movie. And I think it makes so much sense to me that this movie works as well as it does, not least because one of the writers is Dan Greger, who's married to Rachel Bloom. And I doubt, I assume neither of you have seen Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, right?
I have not.
No. Okay. Bloom is kind of this mad genius, and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is a musical about a lawyer who essentially like has a dissociative break and moves to this small town in California to like try and win her summer camp boyfriend back. And every single song is full of this kind of like weird juxtaposition of sort of style and content and like inappropriateness. And I mean, clearly Greger is like as smart and as weird as his wife is. But the minute that I saw her post that, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. Because it's that, I mean, I do think it's very hard to be, you know, stupid in a way that ends up seeming smart, right? And so for something like the Black Eyed Peas reference to like pay off in a final sequence with the use of Fergalicious, it's like, it's so dumb and it takes such sort of consideration to be the right kind of stupid in every single one of these moments. And for this movie to be the right kind of stupid so frequently and so consistently is just an incredible feat. Also, Neeson and Anderson are great in this. They're so good. And I love that they're dating. It's like the sweetest thing in the world.
It is sweet.
It's going to be sweet until they get murdered by a snowman.
No, yeah. They will save each other from the snowman because this is true love, Peter Sudermann.
One of the, again, this is a very writerly movie and everything kind of pays off at the end. For instance, there is, and I didn't even catch this until I was reading some of the other reviews about it, but there is Liam Neeson does a whole riff at the beginning of the film about how Janet Jackson was unfairly maligned in the Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction thing, and as the film comes to its climax, he has his own wardrobe malfunction at a UFC style fight. I won't spoil it beyond that, but it is like, it is just this very, it's very intricately layered. There are like callbacks you don't even really realize are callbacks until you watch them on the second time around. And I do think that this movie will, as a result, have a long shelf life. I think this is the sort of movie that people will watch over and over again to get those riffs and do the kind of live read versions with their friends. Like, this is the sort of movie that would have killed on college campuses on DVD circa 2002, yep. I mean, right? Like, this is that
totally
sort of
like Anchorman, Wedding Crashers vibes, even though those movies involved a lot more improvisation.
So here's my question for you guys, since you brought up the kind of, it would have killed on college campuses 20 years ago. If you look at some of the box office reporting, like the demographic breakdown is that this movie did reasonably well at the high end of expectations over the weekend. And it was driven by Gen X and elder millennial men, like, is the takeaway on this. And makes sense, right? That's who grew up watching The Naked Gun. That's who that's the group for whom Leslie Nielsen's deadpan and his particular brand of comedy was a formative experience. But I think the thing that makes me just a little bit sad isn't quite right, but like wondering about, I don't know, the kids these days, which is usually not my role on this podcast, but like, is that this movie ends with an invocation to like old men are great, right? It's clearly targeted at a much older audience than those Naked Gun films were. Those old Abraham Zucker films were aimed at bright kids. Like, yes, you could appreciate them if you were a teenager or a college kid or, you know, even an adult who had a particular sense of humor. My dad certainly liked them, but they were definitely intended to be consumed by, you know, 12-year-olds of a certain type who had a certain sensibility. And it's part of that was that they assumed a huge amount of cultural knowledge, but then we're also kind of could be funny if you didn't understand every single reference point, but the assumption of cultural knowledge that was built into those previous films isn't something that I think you can do anymore, not in the same way, because so much of that cultural knowledge at the time was just bound up in you've seen a lot of movies. And even if you haven't seen them, you kind of know the vibe. And all of the movie references here are older, not like classics, not Wizard of Oz, but it starts with a Dark Knight riff. I mean, you know, something from the aughts. We get a couple of John Wick jokes at the end, right, with the kind of the way he's throwing guns at people and bouncing the clips in and out of the gun. This is, you know, it's stuff that is not like quite new and hip with the youth, this is exactly how cool I am, guys, right? And it just strikes me that it would be very difficult to make something in that old style for people aimed very much that it was primarily aimed at people under 25, because you don't have the same sort of universe of shared cultural reference points where you could basically assume that people were listening to music and watching movies and watching television, and they kind of had a sense of what was going on in those three mediums. And that was their cultural world.
That's not really why the Zsasz movies worked, though. Those were not referential films, I don't think. I mean, maybe I'm misremembering.
Well, there are quite a few very specific spoof, like parody elements in all of those films. I mean, just the whole idea of the Police Squad of Naked Gun is that it was kind of a riff on Dragnet and then all of the other cop films. But then there's the one, I think it's 33 and a third, it might be 2.5, that starts with an extremely complicated and extended reference to The Untouchables, right? Just off the top of my head. I haven't seen these movies in quite a while here, but like they were definitely, they just existed in a kind of cultural milieu that like assumed that you had seen or were aware of a very large number of movies, kind of knew the world of music and had watched, and like, again, had either watched or were aware of a lot of television.
Yeah.
Sure. But like, for instance, you mentioned the riff at the beginning of this movie, the new Naked Gun, which is very similar to the Joker bank robbery scene at the beginning of The Dark Knight. But I don't think you don't have to. The joke is not, look at this, it's like a Batman movie. It's just kind of like using the same setting and score. And like, if you recognize a reference, it's fine. But
I definitely left the score start before you see any of the images. And you get this, like, I've heard that. Oh, and then as soon as you, like the moment your brain picks up that this is a riff on, you know, the Nolan style Blom Dark Knight score, you get the, oh, we're in a bank and it's pretty much the same setup, right? It's the same color scheme, that sort of highly golden black, you know, sort of dusty brown scheme that he used for that, right? Like, this is, I mean, it sets you up to be amused. It's a sort of little joke that helps serves as the foundation for a lot of the rest of the jokes in that sequence. I actually think that sequence is one of the weaker ones in the film, but there's a bunch of that here, but all the references are aimed at people who are at least 35 and up, if not older.
I think though that references to Dragnet, for example, were also aimed at older people, right? I mean, at the time that The Naked Gun was coming out, like Dragnet, you could make fun of Dragnet in this way, in part because it was like what older people watched. And I would say, I think this movie is full of cultural references, but just to return to a theme that we've discussed a lot on this podcast, they're not movie references, right? So, you know, you've got the self-driving cars, you have the, you know, like the sort of bunker and prepper mentality among tech people, which if you're, you know, followed, like Sam Altman is like a prepper among other things. You know, you have, for example, like the red light masks that are part of a joke in this movie are like a huge thing among sort of beauty influencers right now. And there's definitely been a move to sort of like make them for guys. And so the, you know, even the use of like Ultimate Fighting, right? And it's like, there's a great little joke buried in the visuals of that, which is that NPR is one of the sponsors of the WWFC.
I didn't see that.
Yes, so they're like, it's in the sponsors on the Octagon. And so I do think that this will feel sort of culturally recognizable to a lot of quite younger people. The question is whether they will actually see it and how they get to see it.
Well, they're all gonna end up watching it on streaming and on
PC. No, they're gonna watch it at the Sphere.
Yes.
They're gonna watch it on the Sphere in 16K with extra, I don't know, extra what? Extra jokes? Extra puns. I hope the AI can add in AI can jokes. Add in some extra puns. Also, the joke that actually cracked me up the most in this was just when we first get into our evil billionaire's like his not his lair but like his tech his office basically.
Yeah,
he's showing people around and there's all these like inspirational like not even inspirational. There's these like promotional signs featuring him like with his products of the future and. You know, like some like cool word and he's like got the hero pose, his arms crossed. And then you get to the last one and he's just standing in a patch of pumpkins and it just says pumpkins. And there's no, it's nothing. There's no, it's not a reference to anything. It's just stupid. And I loved it. I loved how stupid this movie was.
One note I will also, did you guys get the trailer for the new Aziz Ansari movie before this? It's got Keanu Reeves playing a guardian angel, and Aziz Ansari is a guy who like clearly works in an Amazon warehouse. And again, it's one of those blink and you miss it things in The Naked Gun, but like one of the things in the billionaire's lair is like boxes with like the Amazon Prime blue tape. And clearly, like it's interesting to see Hollywood kind of nudging Jeff Bezos, especially given the extent to which he wanted Amazon to like move into the original content game. I noticed that as like an interesting little cultural shift and maybe something they put a pin in for later.
Yeah. Although the guy in this movie, the villain in this movie is very clearly more modeled on Elon Musk.
Yes, absolutely. But
down to Kevin Durand, like kind of is a Elon Musk lookalike almost in some ways, or they have a very similar kind of vibe. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Naked Gun? Peter.
Thumbs up. This is the funniest movie I've seen in years in a theater.
Alyssa.
Thumbs way up. It's as you can tell from my total hysteria earlier on this podcast, it's very funny.
I also give it a thumbs up. And I do hope folks check it out. This is the sort of movie that relies very strongly on word of mouth to kind of build an audience over a several week stretch here. So if you like funny things, you should go see this movie. That's what I have to say about that. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Dante DiCicco. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.